Good afternoon and welcome to Level Up Podcast. I'm your host, Desmond Stinney, once again here with New York Times bestselling Addison Wiggin. How you doing, sir?
You always figure a way to sneak that in.
I have to sneak it. It has to be the start of the show. At one point, we're going to have to start plugging the book so that they know what you were New York Times bestseller for, right?
Right. At some point.
At some point. We'll get to that. But yeah, fresh off your trip from New Hampshire. Welcome back.
Yeah, you know what I did? I cut down 9 different trees. I was teaching my son how to use a chainsaw. And,
sounds dangerous.
There were 3 of us working on it. My stepdad, I guess, if my mom married later in life, and he's kind of running the show, and we were teaching my son how to cut down trees, but it was like 100 degrees out.
In New Hampshire?
Yeah. Well, New Hampshire gets hot. So it's not that much. Not different than Maryland, but it's just shorter period of time. But it was like 98, and then the humidity index put it at like 104.
I don't think anybody in Maryland thinks New Hampshire gets warm. It just feels like...
Well, it is what it is.
It is, yeah. That's awesome.
Anyway, so we were cutting trees, and we could have stopped, but we didn't.
Yeah, sounds fun, but I'm just glad everyone made it back with all their limbs. That's dangerous work.
Yeah, it can be.
Good stuff. Well, we're back at it, man. I'm really excited for this show. I'm all juiced up because not only do we get to talk about some topics that I'm passionate about, I get to talk about them with a very good friend of mine who I've known for 30 years, and get to hear his story over the past 30 years. That's exciting. So, but you know, dealing with that, we have a particular interest in this, you know, folks that are working in the skilled trades arena. And we want to do everything we can to highlight businesses and successful businesses that are doing work in the trades. And today we get to interview Grant Gottlinger from Gott Electric and hear his story. So, Grant, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing great. How is everyone?
Hey, Grant.
Awesome, man. Awesome. So, man, so let's just take it back. We were in 1995, you and I. Were introduced by a mutual friend who knew we were both going to Towson U, go Tigers. Mm-hmm. We ended up meeting your roommate, Christian Aiello. All of us ended up becoming fast and very good friends.
Oh, yeah.
An amazing year at TU in 1995, fall of 1995.
Yep.
And and then the band split up the next year. Christian went to Colorado. And you went another path. I ended up struggling through, barely. Still wake up wondering if I actually made it. But
well, you did.
Yeah, man. But now you have Gott Electric. We're going to get into your business very shortly here. But I, you know, for 30 years, I've just been wanting to hear the story. You know, how did you go from what was the path like from those days in 1995 till today?
We got to talk a little bit about our freshman year a little bit, but we can get back to that. That was some of the more fun adventures with you guys, and it was a lot of fun. I remember us driving to ECU for Halloween one time, like in the middle of the night.
I kidnapped you guys.
Pretty crazy.
Why do we all need to go?
It was I'll never forget that. That was a great trip. Wanted to go back to Towson. Really didn't have any real, you know, I was going to become a history teacher, right? Like that was kind of the path I was looking at. Mm-hmm. Came home after my freshman year, which I didn't do terrible. You know, I took 4 classes a semester, maybe dropped one of them, but you know, I got like, I think it was like 2.9 GPA. You know, not bad, right, for a freshman. But anyway, was told basically if I wanted to go back to college, I had to figure out a way to finance it myself, and I was given about 2 weeks to figure that out. So that became like, gotta figure that out. Yeah. So ended up going to community college for a few years, worked as a, you know, bank teller, waiter, and then got in, you know, I had worked as an electrician in one of the summers prior to going to college. And, you know, basically once I kind of ran the course with the community solid, the college effort and all the other things. I kind of just went back to that. And then, you know, in doing so, one of the things that was important to me when I went back into that was that the company that I went to work for had some sort of apprenticeship program.
Mm-hmm.
And so we ended up going back to the work with that company. I worked with them for about 4 years and went through the IEC, which is the Independent Electrical Contracting Association, Chesapeake chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And, basically at that time you had to go through the 4 years and actually sit for an exam and pass my journeyman's test. And then basically worked for, two other companies, for about 7.5. So in Maryland, you have to be an electrician for 7.5 years with school to even sit for your master's exam in the state. So once I had the 7.5 years, I was like immediate. Like, I went to my boss. I was pregnant with my family. You know, my wife and I were pregnant with our first kid. And I went to my boss for a raise, and he said no or something along those lines. And I was like, can't live off this. So I went and immediately signed up for a 6-month prep course to take the master's exam in Maryland, and took that, set up the test to basically sort of happen right at the end of that 6 months. And, I got my master's license in the state of Maryland. So I ended up starting an LLC pretty much right away. Still worked with a company that I was working for about another 6 months. And then finally that kind of dissolved as well. And so with basically a van, you know, bought a van. I think it was like $21,000 back then, and total shell, and set up some, basically, at the time, you know, they still have them, but there was like lead generating companies that you could use to pay for each lead. And I just started doing it myself, you know, basically for a few years. When I started Got Electric, I did start it with a partner of mine named Todd Grantham. He is still a partner here. And basically, I worked with him for almost 5-6 years. Again, I don't know, lost track of it. He was basically the mechanic I worked under. We wired some really massive custom homes for a while. And then we kind of got our own, you know, I got my own truck or van and started running a crew myself at some point. But basically when we started Got Electric, you know, we did it with really no money. You know, prior to starting the company, I did work pretty much every single weekend for an entire year.
Mm-hmm.
Basically doing like the side hustle thing.
Got it.
And basically got it set up and we started rolling. Did the same type of work we were doing until about 2008, when basically the market, the banking market sort of failed on all of us. And all of the work that I was doing really at that point was all generated by people, you know, basically pulling equity out and remodeling their homes and doing stuff like that. So when that stopped, you know, I had just bought a house, and I was in the process of having twins. Right. And basically the whole world collapsed. So
your market pretty much just almost go away. Wow.
Yeah.
You were doing a lot of residential work.
That was
now.
Financial crisis in 2008. Right?
Yep. Yeah. And so when that happened, I just happened to be sitting in my office one day and a company from New Jersey called me and asked me if I'd be interested in doing, you know, basically putting solar on strip malls. They were very cryptic. They wouldn't tell me very much about it. And, you know, I joke and I tell this story. I was like, I probably would have cut that dude's grass at that point, you know. I would have done anything. But we ended up meeting at a Panera in Germantown, and we met the whole team, and they ended up taking me under their wing. I mean, they needed me too. They needed my license in the state, and then they put me to work. So we ended up doing a couple Kohl's. First one we did was in Eldersburg. It was like 260 kW was the first solar project I ever built, which back then was extremely large. Nobody was doing anything. In fact, I couldn't find anything on the internet about solar. Like I was, you know, immediately once inserted into this world, I was like, let's go find more work. You know, I'm going to rely on just one company to keep me busy. And I couldn't find anybody. Like at the time, the only thing I could find, I remember it, was that there was a ribbon cutting ceremony in California that I think Arnold Schwarzenegger was at, or I think he was governor at the time or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was cutting a ribbon on a, say, a 40 kW system. And it was like a real big deal, right? Meanwhile, I'm building, you know, something that's basically six times the size of that. Uh-huh. And nobody even knows, like nobody, you know? Right. So I was like, I kind of was, felt like I got in front of something. You know, there's all the naysayers, you know, over the course of the next few years, like be careful how much you invest in this. It could just disappear. But I just felt like it was meant to be, you know. I don't know how to explain it better. Just it basically energized me. I had been doing the same type of electric work for a very long time. And once I got into that, it was like something new, and you know, just felt new. And it was like everyone we were working with was kind of just figuring it out. It's very, very, very like wild, wild west at times, you know? And I met a lot of very interesting people over that couple of years. But basically the industry kind of matured, and, you know, started meeting some new people, met a group that basically owned a company called like Clean Currents, and they ended up getting acquired by SolarCity, and basically became like the East Coast management of that company when they first started on the East Coast, and grew really rapidly. But basically we ended up helping them build some projects out here, and you know, other companies like Standard Solar, basically we were working with them, and they started to stand up on their own, got investment from some people, and then you know, they've since become a massive company owned by Brookfield Renewables, right? And we still work with them today. We're actually building their largest ground mount that they've ever built. They know they've acquired bigger, but this is the biggest project they've ever done internally to themselves. And it's just been a great ride. I mean,
Going back to, you said 7.5 years to get your to be able to sit for your masters. Is that typical? Like, what's it like in most in other states? Is it?
Yeah, no, it's pretty common for that to be the way it is. Since I went to school, they have actually changed it. I'll give you two examples of kind of like a weird situation. So, back in about 2 years ago, the state of Maryland basically gave me about 6 months where I could basically give anyone, I could have given both of you journeyman's licenses if I wanted to. They actually put the ability for me to sign off on people that, obviously, I mean, yeah, that's just saying, but like basically anyone I felt was worthy, I could give them a journeyman's license, which is obviously an interesting concept, because obviously you have to have some morals to yourself to only provide it. And I did not give it to everyone. There's a couple of kids that I've been trying to have go to school who have been working here for a while, and I didn't go. And I was like, you know, these kids went to school. You didn't. I'm not just going to give you a license. You should have gone to school. You had every opportunity. We pay for half of it. There's no real reason not to go, you know, other than just being lazy. So basically, you know, that was one thing. But also, in the course of some, I don't know when this happened, but basically now when you take the 4-year program at the IEC, you automatically graduate with a journeyman's license.
Okay.
That reciprocates to a couple of different places. So they've kind of made it a little easier, obviously, for everyone to participate. And the journeyman's license, what it provides is, you know, basically a benchmark for where, you know, rates are. So, you know, your first year you get a certain amount of money and so on. Mm-hmm. Once you get to a journeyman license is kind of saying, hey, I'm qualified, I'm here. And, you know, you get basically the state kind of mandates what you make when you're on certain projects. So, but yeah, every state has rules with regards to that. And then also some states are very particular on being a resident like you know, if you want to work in say certain states like Massachusetts, you typically have to be there for a while. You know, you can't just walk into Massachusetts and start doing electric work. You need to have someone from the state be a part of the process.
Yeah,
there's a bunch of there's a couple other states that are like that as well.
Yeah, that's interesting. You would think electricity is the same in Massachusetts as it is in Connecticut, but
yeah, they're just protecting work. You know, yeah. I mean, they're very, very protective.
Got it.
Is there unions involved too? I'm asking that question for a specific reason.
Yeah, so a lot of the like the testing requirement. So the union, I think was the reason. So they were giving their journeyman's licenses to their apprentices at the end of their program. So that's kind of why I think the IEC ended up doing it as well. But yeah, the union, you know, union's a big part of, you know, massive amount of lobbying, right? So like they can dictate some rules. They're pushing pretty hard in the state of Maryland to push in what they call PLAs, which are, you know, project labor agreements. And this state has been pretty much say not doing that. Like they haven't had that pressure. We do have a very pro-union, you know, governor in the office right now, but you know, there was a statistic at one point that I read somewhere that basically like the union does like 8% of the work in Maryland.
Mm.
So they're not as strong here but you know, they have like obviously like the data centers, which are done by both independent and union contractors, but they also, you know, have a lot of government, you know, contracting, which is
right.
Do they help in the process of becoming, I mean, they have a program that you can get your journeyman license, but then from journeyman to masters, is it beneficial to be part of a union or does it, you can follow your own program?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think anybody that ends up getting a master's license is basically just pursuing that for themselves individually. I think your company that you know work like we want everyone to continue. Like it doesn't, like once, you know, you only need one master per company per se. Like, you know, obviously some projects may have some stipulations on them. I've been on projects for like DOT where like you have to have a master electrician on site, which becomes somewhat burdensome because there's not a lot of us. So that becomes, you know, very difficult at times. But yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, personally, like I'd tell anyone, you know, if you're going to get into the trade, go keep going, right? Get your master's license. That way, if you ever want to work for yourself, you can. You know, I mean, that's really why I did it. You know, I was like, I wanted to be able to control sort of like what I did, and I wasn't going to be told what I was worth by anybody else. You know, I mean, I can create as much wealth as I want if I get this and work as many hours as I want, if I, you know, and that's why I did it.
Yeah. Yeah. So going back to 2008, you were largely doing residential projects. The residential market dried up with the housing collapse and, you know, people ran out of their refi money.
Mm-hmm.
How big was your company at that time?
We were six people. So it was basically, you know, Todd, myself, and another gentleman named Alan, and then three apprentices, basically. So we had three vans running, and we were just doing what we were normally doing. And then when that all stopped, we kept them, you know, we tried to keep the one van running for as long as we could, and it just didn't work. So we had to lay off those two guys.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up bringing both those guys back once I got my feet under me and was actually doing the solar thing again. So they came back to work for us. But, yeah, I mean, we grew from, I would say, like in 2011, I probably had 12 people.
So doubled in size, been within that 2-year window.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's actually, I remember that whole period because I was obviously covering the housing market.
Right.
It, just the stuff that I was writing, the way that they were financing mortgage-backed securities and all that was driving a huge chunk of the economy. And
a huge chunk. Yeah.
Fell apart.
Well, the firm I was at Lehman. Yeah, we were holding a lot of that paper.
But I also remember when, after things fell apart, the tax incentives for solar were part of the remedy that was put into place that the legislative packages put together, included solar. So it's interesting to me to hear you say that it worked.
Oh, I mean, it 100. So, like, in the story I've been told by a few different people in the industry, that's basically there was a company called Sun Edison. Yeah. I guess the gentleman that started that company was a gentleman you can, he's like, I think he was on, I want to say he was in the Clinton cabinet at some point, but Jigar Shah basically created sort of like the financial model for the solar PPA. And one of the first groups of the group that basically was really pushing and owned all of, I believe all of, you know, was utilizing the tax credit was Goldman Sachs through Sun Edison. It's basically kind of through the, you know, I don't have that to be 100% true, but like based on what I was hearing from the project managers and the people that I dealt with through Sun Edison, they were saying this is where the money was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, I mean, it 100% worked. I mean, we were able, I mean, one of the things that did happen in the beginning of solar is it basically that only the second half of every year typically was when everything was built. So like the first half of the year, we had to like scrounge and figure out how to stay busy, which kept us, we would get bigger and then we'd have to, you know, let go of some people, get bigger, you know, it kept us, we were able to find good people that way too. Like, you know, you keep the people that are actually, you know, basically cutting the fat type of thing. Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, it helped us in a way. You know, we traveled a ton. That was the other thing is that, you know, one of the things that I had to do, right? There wasn't really a choice. You know, we traveled all over the place. And the group that, you know, I was working with down here took me, you know, to all the projects they were doing all over the place. And then we got involved with like Solar City, and they took us wherever they needed us. And so we traveled to New Haven, we traveled to Syracuse, you know, as far as Lexington, Virginia. I mean, you know, we were all over the place, spending a lot of time on the Eastern Shore.
Yeah.
Working, you know, basically 6 months of 1 year, I was not home. I mean, not all at the same time, but basically over a course of a year. So that, you know, we chased the work and we just kept going at it. Learned a lot. You know, just kept building it. And then, you know, some point, and it's sort of like foggy, right? And all of a sudden it just sort of became like, there was another couple companies came about that started utilizing us. They knew who we are. We kind of made a name for ourselves, like that we were like, you know, basically in the solar game. So we started doing work for other people. And then it just kind of just honestly, like really in, you know, 2015, it started to really take off. 14, 15. And then in 2018, we brought in another partner who started our Virginia office with us. We had been working with him. I'd known him since 2010. I met him when he was working at Standard Solar.
Mm-hmm.
And then he kind of moved around himself all over the place. And then basically came back here. He's from Harrisonburg. So, we had a group down there that was developing a lot of work. And actually Andy Hirschberg is his name, basically started a company prior to him becoming a partner at God Electric, but we got into the market too soon. And it just kind of fizzled. And so he went back to work for somebody and we just kept carrying on doing what we were doing. And then basically when he came back, around when the Virginia market, a lot of people didn't realize, probably would never know this, but basically at one point in Virginia, the only entity that was allowed to sell energy in the state was Dominion. And they kind of held on to that for quite some time to, you know, fighting a lot of legal battles, I'm sure. But basically once that kind of broke free, that market opened up. So we've been building a lot of projects on schools in Virginia for a while. Like we've done a ton of counties down there. And he's been very successful in setting up our office and running our Virginia basically branch. And we, you know, have since made him basically, we're all equal now, you know, we made him basically a full partner, you know, with
right.
But,
I have to ask this, cause I'm just curious. Dominion's big in, providing energy for direct to data centers. I've been writing a lot recently about AI and how data centers are necessary and they use up a lot more electricity and they compete with the residential grid. And that is happening in the Mid-Atlantic area. In Northern Virginia, Dominion kind of like owns the market for providing energy to data centers. It's a big deal for government contracts and stuff like that.
Yeah. They've been sort of like, I mean, between nuclear and basically Tennessee Hydro, like their REC market never really became something that was actually like, you know, that kind of helped pencil projects. So it was hard. Like they basically kept that market very difficult to operate. Like most companies steered away from it because it was just not low hanging fruit. Right. So like Maryland's REC market at one point was pretty hot. You know, DC's is still pretty ridiculous. PA at one point allowed you to get your REC credits from outside of, say, PA. They actually changed that some time ago, but when it first all started, you could, you know, basically build in, you know, a solar project and sell your RECs into PA.
Can you explain what RECs are?
Renewable energy certificates. Yep. So yeah. Every million watt hours a solar project produces basically creates a REC credit, and then they're able to sell it on the open market, I guess, to whoever wants to buy them. Never done that, so I don't know.
So in Dot Electric, you're primarily bidding out to the jobs, or they come to you looking to,
yeah, I mean, so in the we got into it and basically now it's sort of like we do have to, I still, you know, go out and try to find additional customers, but there's a good group of people that, you know what we provide. Right. And so they come to us and, you know, we bid those projects. So it sort of feeds itself now. Our name in the industry is fairly decent. We sort of overbuild things. I feel like, and in our costs sometimes show that. So we're not typically the cheapest, but when we're done, the project typically is done with no punch list. You know, like there's, you know, basically I can give you that little background. So like when these projects get built, you know, there's a lot of eyes on them. You know, there's usually like a bank inspection. You know, somebody hired third party, not even the HJ is going to look at it. There's going to be a bank inspector that's going to look at it. You know, whoever owns it's going to have their own people, you know, or the bank, you know, so we've learned to build things in a manner that we don't want the punch list, right? The punch list has us going back to a project maybe we've demobilized from, and also if the punch list is you know sufficient enough, it can cause a delay in payment, which is something that, you know, we live and die by, getting paid on time. So our guys are very aware. Over the course, I've, you know, taught everyone kind of what these companies look for, you know, and, you know, and I'm not saying them all, but like a lot of them, you know, anytime they can figure out a way, you know, it used to be pay ops. Like if you did a pay op wrong, you know, starts the clock over on the pay, you know, like, and that was just like, ugh. But so now, you know, we try to get in front of any way for us not to get paid on time. So we're always very proactive about that. So the best way to do that is just overbuild things, be better, yeah. You know? So, yeah. And that's helped us be very successful, to be honest.
With the different partners and stuff you have, how many employees you currently have?
Oh, so we're floating, I think right now, between 90 and 100 people.
Yeah. Wow.
So
wow.
It's grown quite a bit.
That's interesting to me, because one of the things we've been covering and talking about and writing about is the difficulty for trades businesses to actually make it and be successful. And you've obviously, you know, crushed those odds. And one, I'm wondering, is that something that you've noticed in the industry, that, you know, businesses are here today and gone tomorrow, at any point, and, you know,
yeah,
in this space?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've seen a lot of people try to get big too quickly, right? Mm-hmm. That's happened a lot of times. You know, a lot, I could, you know, name them, but I'm not, I mean, there's definitely people I've worked mm-hmm. with that, you know, are just going after everything. And we were very, you know, there was two reasons. One, we didn't have any real money behind us. It's, you know, still really don't, but we just self finance everything. Yeah. Now, but like, basically in the beginning, you know, I had my Amex card. I think I at one point had like a $300,000 line of credit with some bank, you know, and that was it. So we had to be particular on how, who we worked with and, you know, basically just grinded it out. Right. So we didn't really have, I say that I never tried to get too big, but I really just didn't have a choice. But honestly, there was times where we were just like, I had to turn away, you know, millions and millions of dollars of work, because I just wasn't going to go and put people that weren't qualified on projects and just have it become a complete shit show, right? So that's a real thing, and I saw that happen. Like it happened probably 6-7 times that I've seen people just, you know, go and get success. You know, they bid something, they're doing it, and they go to do another one, or they go to a state that they're not familiar with and just get hammered and
right. Lights out.
Basically. Being small and being nimble and being able to just basically do enough to keep growing at a very nice slow pace.
Yeah. And it sounds like you found your lane, right? And then, you know, tried to stay in that lane, really.
Yeah. That's the other, I mean, we are an electrical contracting company that does solar. We get now asked quite frequently to what they call EPC work. So like EPCing is basically engineering, the procurement, and the construction. What'll happen is a developer will come to us and say, okay, we want you to take on this. They'll basically put it out to our, you know, basically bid, right? Request for proposal. And basically what happens then is that basically we can either choose to bid it as that entity, which is the EPC, which we really only do in Virginia for the most part. We have EPC'd some work in Maryland, but it's not really our lane, like you just said. Now, as this market matures and as you know, people have come to us because of our quality and they want us to do, you know, the EPC model, and we entertain it, but it's truly not our lane in Maryland. Mm-hmm. And it's because, you know, honestly, like, we do a work for quite a few people, and then honestly doing that, if we decided to become an EPC, we would probably cut off some of our current buckets, right? They would just stop utilizing us. They'd look at us as a competitor. But truthfully, it's also like with regards to like some of the contract language and these agreements with on the development from the developer to the EPC, it's sort of a risk that I just don't see is valued enough.
Right.
You get what
right.
I'm saying? Like, so it's like, it doesn't make sense to me. And really to my team, you know, it's just, we kind of just understand we can operate in this space. I understand all the things I need to do here. When you get into the other world where, you know, you're looking at, you know, just unforeseens that can come about that you are on the hook for, like, the developers basically got you, you know, you said you can do it for this price, go get it done. And it's a nice number if you do everything. If it goes smoothly, you probably make an awesome margin and everything's great. But it's that one time where you just get into something terrible. And, you know, that model is more like the volume model, right? So you get, you know, 7 winners and 2, you know, 3 losers. You're not going to fall apart. But we're not set up that way. I think you have to have some money behind you to really operate in that space. Mm-hmm. But we don't have that, so...
Yeah. So a typical project, what does it look like? Like, who's, when you're going out and doing your jobs, like, where are they, on malls? Are they on buildings? What, or everything?
Yeah. So, I mean, in the beginning, it was a lot of box buildings. And it went from Kohl's to Walmart's, Sam's Clubs. That was kind of the first rollout of like that particular type of work. There was also like the municipality type work where, you know, mm-hmm. they would sell PPAs to school systems and we would do some schools. But mainly CNI, what they call it, like basically commercial and industrial space up on roofs.
Right.
Like the first ground mount we ever built was, no, it's not the first, but basically the largest one we built to that at that time was a 2.2 meg site on the Eastern Shore for Solar City, which I was told at the time was the largest project for them on this side of the Mississippi or this side of the country. And it was, that was a, you know, a nice project, kind of put us on our on the map of, you know, cause really nobody had really done that over here for the most part. It was kind of a really large project for this side of the country. They were doing some of that in New Jersey, but in Maryland, that was like not really being done yet. But yeah, so you basically have, you know, the schools, the PPA is on top of on the basically the you know, basically retail. So, you know, pretty much every box building in Maryland pretty much has solar on it. Maryland, New Jersey, there's probably a few, you know, a bunch in Pennsylvania. Virginia's market's kind of not had that push yet. Yeah. But yeah, those are the spaces. And then we kind right. of we graduated into the utility space. So we ended up building a 10 meg solar project on a site just north of Riley. I'm in Frederick. And that was another real big step for us, because it was like, you're getting into the bigger stuff, right? And then, you know, bouncing around doing both, and then graduate, you know, and then during COVID, we got asked to build a 13 meg and a 20 meg. And we did those two. And so that kind of set us up with some of the bigger names in the industry with regards to like development work. They knew who we are. We actually built a project for a company, which will remain, I just won't drop the name, but basically they ended up flying all of the people that were building projects throughout the country to their site to basically look at it. And I actually was told this multiple times from people from their company, like they want, this is how it's going to be built. This is it. If you can do this, you can work for us. And so that was a good feeling. That was a nice project for us, but, yeah. And then in 2018, we expanded into, well, we were already working in Virginia, but basically that market sort of turned on, and, we brought Andy in, and he kind of stood up. We built, you know, basically we got 3 acres down there with a warehouse on that 3 acres, and basically stood up a bunch of guys building solar. We used guys from Maryland to in the beginning to help him, but we ended up getting him on under his, you know, his feet under him, and he's now basically, you know, just running. Like there's a ton of work down there.
It sounds like you've had like some really key, you know, decision points as far as like which way the business could go. You know, either whether it's expanding into certain geographical areas, mm-hmm. or, you know, choosing the lane that you felt like you could play the best in. How did those decisions get made? Was it, who was involved in that? Do you have a board, or is it just kind of?
No, I mean, we really, like in the beginning, I mean, really all the decisions were like, let's go find work and be able to make money. I mean, we were chasing the work. We kind of really moved out of doing the commercial work because it was so stagnant in the beginning, you know, and the rates to do that work, you know, the margins on the work were not great. And you know, and things happened, like, you know, the data center world kind of turned on even harder, I think, then. So like some of our competition that would may have gotten into the solar game kind of just was, hey, that was easy button for them. So we just kind of stood in a place where like nobody really wanted, like we were like, nobody really wanted to, you know, electrical companies didn't really want to operate in the solar world. Mm. You know, there's a real difference between, say, you know, an outside electrician, as I, you know, say, or an inside electrician. You have a very different group of people. It's totally different work. You know, you're in the elements, you're dealing with the cold and the hot and rain and snow. So it's very difficult work. It's not an easy job. And the guys have to, you know, we've been fortunate to keep people moving. I think that, you know, we've been very, very, you know, up until really recently, did we have any real turnover? Mm-hmm. We were able to keep people here and working, because we were very close. You know, I truly didn't stop working in the field and sweating through my clothes until about 2018-19.
Right.
You know, that change happened when we got big enough where I had to feed the machine. So now I'm, you know, basically creating, you know, team inside that basically is doing, you know, project management and doing right. you know, estimating and stuff like that. So
yeah. Let's dive into that. A lot of the, you know, things that I'm reading is talking about the labor market, mm-hmm. especially in the trades. I've read reports where, you know, up to approximately 40 million people who started college but didn't get a credential. But there's also, at the same time, you know, the trades industry across the board. And I think you ran into some statistics, Addison, recently, just about electricians and specifically, right, where there's just way more work than there are people to perform the work.
Yeah, so, there's about 500,000 open jobs in the electrical field right now.
That's the exact number that you sent.
But the important thing of that is not the openings, because like you could look at it as from the macro perspective, there's a lot of jobs opening.
Yeah.
From your perspective, though, it's you're actually on the ground and the work needs to get done. There's like a divide between people understanding that there's a huge need for electricians.
Mm-hmm.
And actually being on the ground and like not having enough people to do the work. It's kind of interesting. And the reason we're even going in this direction is because on the app, I'm actually looking at the app because it's pretty interesting. We have this theme where we want to make trades cool again because the work does need to get done and we all are dependent on it. I've been writing a lot about AI and data centers, like I said, that all requires skilled labor. It's electricians and people that can work with the hardware and like build the centers and everything. And there's not enough people to do all that. And yet somehow there's a perception distinction between people that go into the trades and where we started at the beginning of this conversation, people that go to four-year college.
Mm-hmm.
The headline that I'm looking at is we got to make trades cool again because they used to be cool. And for some reason they're not. And then we picked up some stuff from Mike Rowe, who's on a foundation whose mission is just that. Let's make the trades cool again because we have all this hard work that needs to get done and you need good skilled labor to do it. And it pays well. So it makes a lot of sense for a lot of people to go and use their hands, use their brains and like get the job done.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that doesn't get talked about enough is really what information is being lost. Right. So, I hear a statistic, I'm in some groups too, but basically, you know, it's like 7 to 1 leaving the workforce right now. So like for every 7 people leaving, there's one electrician being made. And the amount of information that is going to be lost in that transition,
right,
is going to be pretty staggering. And then also like I've seen a paradigm shift truly within the last like 3 to 4 years where I am getting some phone calls from some, you know, basically trade schools, you know, community colleges, you know, guidance counselors, parents saying, hey, you know, I want my son or daughter to be involved in the trades. And so I've seen that, which is great, but what is going to happen in it, because it, you know, you just can't just wake up one day and be an electrician. Right. So you're going to have basically a decline. And I think we're just starting it because it's definitely been happening, but I don't think we're going to see that the renewal happen yet. I think it's probably 3 to 4 years away. You're going to see this, you know, this massive push that's been happening over the last like 3 years to get, you know, new people into the trades. But even then, you know, there's companies I know that are like, you know, desperately trying to hold on to the guys that know how to do things and are paying them very well to stay. Right.
Yeah. Firstly, why I was asking about the unions before, because unions historically have been places where people learn trades, they get in and then they get the education they need. And apprenticeships are really important in union settings. And if it's being developed outside, I think that's one of the key, especially with any trade. The skills mostly happen on the job with somebody who's like standing over you. When you make mistakes, they help you fix it.
Well, that's so I kind of hit on, remember when I said I could make you guys journeymen. So what happened is when Maryland basically had all of the policing of say licensing, you could go get your license from the state of Maryland, but you could also get it from the county you lived in. And you could get your journeyman's license from that entity as well. And so, you know, basically at that point, somewhere along the line, they had changed the ratio from 3 to 1, which means that you could have one journeyman three apprentices work under one journeyman. And that was like the ratio that they were had. But when they just recently, I think in the last like 2 to 2 years, 3 years, they changed it, actually it was like 3 or 4 years, but everything goes by so fast. But basically they changed it back. So they abolished basically all of the policing of licensing at the county level. And so now the state of Maryland basically is the only entity that can give you a license, right? So you can get your journeyman's license from the state of Maryland and you can get your master's license from the state of Maryland. But they also changed the ratio back to 1-to-1.
Mm.
And so the whole reason for me to, you know, I didn't really explain that well, but the whole reason I was able to give journeyman's licenses to people is so that we could be under that rule. Like, you know, there was, they realized that there just wasn't enough journeymen in the state of Maryland to people couldn't function under the actual law. So they had to basically kind of say, here, let's create journeyman out of thin air, basically. Yeah. And so they did that for 6 months. But yeah, I mean, I think that helped a little bit with regards to the ratios and so on. You know, but yeah, there's
skills training, though.
There's just a ratio that, you know, to create an apprentice, you have to have a journeyman. And, you know, if you're on a site that, you know, actually is, you know, working under that rule, and then you have to have it, otherwise you're going to be in, you know, in an issue. So there was some things that were put out in the IRA, which was the you know, inflation bill, reduction bill, that was really designed to help grow the trades. One of which was basically, so they moved the tax credit back to 30% for solar, but they also put in there that if you used basically an accredited apprenticeship program to build your project, you got another 10%, which I'm not sure where it went. If it's still in there, it might be still in there till the end of this year. I don't know. Everything's got kind of fuzzy. I haven't been paying much attention to it. I've been too busy trying to run a business, but and the work right now doesn't seem to be slowing down, so I'm not overly concerned, but I think that there's other things we can talk about that are going to create more demand for solar. But yeah, so basically, you know, the government got in and said, hey, we want to build, you know, a way for the money, right, to get to create these groups of people that are going to basically use the apprenticeship programs to build the next workforce. And so that was neat. That we've actually built a few projects with that. We're getting ready to build two more.
Right.
Does any of that go away with the changes that the Trump administration is putting into place?
I would probably say yeah. I mean, based on a lot of what I've read, I think it's getting kind of basically kneecapped. So like they're cutting it off.
The solar credits are getting kneecapped, but the incentive to train skilled trades, I don't think that goes away.
I'd hope not. I mean, it doesn't really make much sense to me, but a lot of things that happen don't make sense to me. So,
and that 7-to-1 ratio you talked about, for every one coming into the electrician's trade, there's seven.
That's just not electrician's trade. That's all trades.
All trades. Where are they going?
I actually heard that from a plumber utility company, you know, yeah, one of the big utility companies, a plumber. He said that his company's losing like seven guys, you know, every year.
Where would they go? I'm trying to understand where's the market.
They're retiring. I mean, they're literally aging out of the workforce.
Okay, I got it. So yeah. All right. So that actually fits. That tracks, because I just finished a content series, writing a content series on the platform about the last 30 to 40 years of, because a lot of it was narrative, right? And it's the four-year colleges won the narrative battle. And I mean, to the point where I got you by a few years, Grant, but back when I was, you know, coming out in, you know, 91, there were still, you know, automotive shops and wood shop. Everything was in, you know, you could do all those things in school. You could change a tire and mm-hmm. change oil and all that good stuff. And all that stuff went away. Right. And, you know, the guidance counselors no longer talk to you about taking the ASVAB or anything else other than the SAT.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it makes sense to have that a larger labor pool that's aging out, like you said, and retiring, mm-hmm. but not having, you know, that the folks that have come in, because the entire narrative about what your career path had had a 4-year degree attached to it, right?
Yeah, so, I'll give you an example of I mean, basically, when I started my apprenticeship program, I was one of 35 kids. When I graduated from that class, I was one of 4.
right. And there was a great story. A guy did an op-ed in the Washington Post, it was, and he was actually in law school at Yale Law School, and his name is Darnell Epps. And he wrote an op-ed. He was in law school. And while he was in law school, his last year of law school, he enrolled in a trade school to be a machinist.
Mm-hmm.
And
the story, yeah.
Yeah. He said he was like his law school had he go to class at law school, be like 65 people in the class. And he'd go to his machinist class. I'm trying to get him on the podcast. Like, I'm really chasing this guy. If he's listening, Darnell, come do Level Up. But he actually did friend me on LinkedIn, so I'm going to have to end this episode. But he was one of like 6 or 7 people in the machinist class.
Yep.
And he's like, he's going to finish that 10-month certification or however long it took him and, you know, have a skill that could earn him damn near 6 figures. I think it was like $80,000 or $85,000 a year. And, you know, that's not bad for someone to go to school for 10 months and have very little debt. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's got 65, you know, soon to be lawyers are going to be scrambling for work and inventing lawsuits to, you know, to file.
Context I put. A follow up to yours was that AI is doing away with a lot of those jobs anyway, like paralegal jobs, mid-level management.
So yep.
Like that, all of those people, they should become electricians.
And you wonder why this country has gotten so litigious.
Yeah.
We're
lawyers.
Yeah, if we got we're drowning in folks with law degrees, and they got to find someone to sue. But yeah. So I think one of the things that we're trying to do, Grant, and with our platform, is to highlight the Grant Gottliebers and the Got Electrics of the world, because we do believe that a lot of what we're seeing has to do with the narrative. And, you know, we know Mike Rowe's doing amazing work with changing the perception of skilled jobs and skilled careers. And, you know, we're jumping right in it. You have a rising senior. You have 2 rising seniors, twin mm-hmm. boys. I've got a rising senior and I'm struggling with it myself, right, at this point, you know.
It's the same with my, I mean, you're watching the world change right now, right? Yeah. Like it is literally, right. I mean, and the kids are getting, they're utilizing this stuff. Like I kind of mess with, you know, ChatGPT, but I don't really utilize any of the technology that is probably right at my fingertips. Mm-hmm. Right? Cause I'm just, you know, we're working on using AI to read contracts, but you know, you still want to put your real eyes on them, but you know, at least they'll speed through all the things and redline the shit that we always redline, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, contracts are very much a copy and paste thing typically.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, you know, we are starting to see a neat or a way to use it and utilize it. But it's going to be, you know,
The world is coming big time, and it's here. And I'll tell you one other use case that I'm, you know, maybe you'll do it, maybe you won't. But a lot of times what I do with chat is I'll take like policy or a bill or legislation that I think is important to me or might impact me. And obviously energy policy is important to you.
Right.
I'll just grab the whole bill text and I don't want to read the 1,000 pages. Like big, beautiful bill. I downloaded it.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it in chat and say, hey, give me the highlights. Here are the things that are important to me.
That's pretty cool.
And, yeah. And it actually just spit back. And obviously, you know, my daughter just graduated from the Coast Guard Academy.
Mm-hmm.
I was at her graduation and Christy Noem was speaking as Secretary Noem. And she was talking about all this money that was going to be put into the Coast Guard with the big, beautiful bill. So I was like, oh, let me go figure it out. I downloaded it, threw it in there and said, tell me what's good in this bill for the Coast Guard. And
was there anything?
It's huge investments. Yeah. Windfall for the Coast Guard. But,
I want to take this conversation one step further, though, because in order to have all that chat working and doing, I use it to write myself because it does a lot of the kind of research that I would be doing manually.
Mm-hmm.
Does great work. But in order to have that, you need electricians to set it up first. Yeah.
And you need people that can weld. It does require power.
I think that, you know, the future of energy in this country, I mean, based on all the things I read too, because like one of the things that happened to me, obviously, growing up as and owning my own business is, you know, I never saw the, you know, the fact that all of a sudden homes would be, you know, upside down. Like, you know, I mean, I didn't know any better. Right. So like, I felt like everybody's, you know, just keep going. The population is growing. Why was this ever going to stop? Right. And so not understanding
book.
The market that I was, you know, utilizing very, very much as like one of my only buckets at the time, I have now seen, you know, I've seen a need to like pay attention to what is going on around me. Right. So like, it's like very important that I understand, you know, what has happened. And, you know, I do know more about what the bill did and everything. It's just, but I don't really want to talk about it, you know, as far as just because, you know, it did just happen. I understood that. It took me about, you know, 4 or 5 months to really understand the IRA and get all that figured out. But with the bill just being passed, I haven't really dug into it. But,
well, that, you know, that happens all the time, right? They pass these 1,000-page bills and then it takes a while for the agencies to implement them.
I mean, if I tell anybody that is in getting into any type of industry, any business, really, I mean, follow the tax credits, right? Like, figure out where the tax credits are going and start, you know, jump on in. I mean, that's what we kind of did here. I mean,
the way it works, though, they can yank the tax credits just as fast as they put them in place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I fish with a guy that, you know, basically developed oil wells in Western Pennsylvania, and he told me that, you know, and this is something like you don't really understand, but like all of the exploration for oil, even if you miss, right, is all tax, like it's all basically tax. You can use tax credits for that is basically what he was telling me. So it's, you know, I mean, I would assume it's still that way.
Policy is important.
Yeah.
But, if they took that ability to write that off, if you miss, it changes the game for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big part of all industry, right? We utilize, and I think that's where you're going to see some of the tax credits go, is to like mini nuclear,
right?
It makes sense to, I mean, why wouldn't it happen, right? They're gonna want that investment class to push into that, and they need it to happen. And you'll see, like, and when I talk about like mini nukes, I mean, if you've done, you know, do just look into it. I mean, it's all over the place right now. I mean, you know, will it be deployed in the next, say, 4 years? Probably not, but you know. Right. Pushing 5 to 6 to 8 years, you're going to see this technology be deployed all over the place, and it's going to be interesting.
That sounds comforting, just nuclear power everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, we've been using it since the 1950s, so I mean, you know, I'm talking about like the same type, you know, obviously the technology has gotten extremely robust and better. I mean, they've got technology now where you don't even need like fresh water, like they just they can deploy a nuclear reactor in a connex, you know, and it just basically takes care of itself. Right
now, they're building out modular nuclear just for data centers, so it's just growing, and it doesn't pull off the residential grid. It doesn't add to it. It just fuels the.
The one thing I have a problem with all that is that they should force those billionaires to pay for that. What they're doing right now is like dumping all of that cost into the consumer.
Well, that has to happen at the legislative level.
It's kind of crazy. Well, I mean, you know, whoever has the biggest pocketbook, right? Yeah. You just lobby for whatever makes
sense.
I mean, for example, in Maryland, you know, when data centers came across the river, and it's coming, right? Adamstown is where this happened. Basically, data centers in Maryland were considered retail space. So they had a different EPA standard for their generators that were on these sites. And they couldn't meet it, I guess, is why the law changed. So basically what they did is there was like a cease and desist to stop this whole thing or get stuck in probably permitting. But basically those guys went to the governor and within, 6 months, 4 months, you know, all of a sudden data centers were not retail anymore. They were infrastructure.
They were
EPA is basically, you know, their rules for that stuff are way more laxed. So
more relaxed.
And when you see these things, I'm sure you guys have, I mean, if you haven't, you should go take a look at it, you know, what that means. I mean, they have redundancy on top of redundancy, right?
So no, my business is in, so I'm hosted in a data center. You're actually speaking on my servers in the data center.
Yeah.
Your own modular nuclear down by the stadium.
Well, I'm just, I just rent a rack, man. I don't own the building.
Yeah. But, well, the racks are 15 grand a month, right? I mean, that's.
Yeah, they're not cheap.
Yeah, the guy told me, so I actually went and toured the facility at Adamstown because they wanted me to wire a building out there that was built, you know, it was built by one of the president's wives. Like this property that's out there is about 600 acres, but it was originally owned a long, long time ago by you know, one of the president's daughters or wives. And they have this huge colonial, like massive farmhouse, and they wanted to utilize that for their office. And so they wanted me to come out and take a look at it. And I was like, yeah, I mean, you just get me, you know, get further along. They were way in front of it, but, and that turned out the building like had, like, I think asbestos in it or something. So they were just like, no, I'm not going to do that. But yeah, they're moving earth out there. I mean, there's a smelting plant that's underground there that was there prior to them that they have to get all of that toxic shit out of there. And that's going to, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. But,
like Adamstown, you mean right after 85, right?
Yeah, so they tunneled under the Potomac. I believe the company is called Quantum Loop. Basically, they tunneled under the Potomac to bring the data from
Fiber from Ashburn. Yeah.
So a lot of people don't know this, and I found out this. I found it interesting, but basically, like the transatlantic fiber run stops in Ashburn. It's like the first stop in or something like that. Somebody told me that. I don't know if that's 100% true, but like that's from, why.
Coming from where? From Europe or from?
From Europe.
Yeah, because it comes in and it was coming in Miami from South America, and then they actually made another stop in Jacksonville in the last 15 years, I believe it was. But from Europe, it goes in Ashburn.
Weird. It's a weird spot.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's 100% true, but it kind of makes sense because that's where AOI was.
AOL. It was AOL that brought it in. Yeah.
But that's why they had to tunnel under the Potomac, and then they're going down 81, down 95. I mean, there's a massive amount of data centers being built around here, Texas. They're talking about building them out in the desert.
All along the Ohio River too.
Yeah, and they need all those data centers because my wife won't delete the pictures on her phone. I'm charging her with that.
Yeah, the guy told me. He said because I asked him. I was like, how you know, explain to me like your business. And he's like, all right. He goes, imagine a 2-foot by 2-foot rack, 8-foot tall. And I was like, yes, all right, I got it. He goes, I can charge $15,000 a month for that.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. And like, you think about how big those buildings are. It's just print money, you know?
Oh, they just it's a great business to invest in. I wish I had the money. And I can tell you that. I was actually talking to a developer here about it. I mean, yeah, so we'll have to do a meeting down at one of the meetings down at the data center so you can see our rack down there, right down by the stadium. But yeah, man, so you're off to, where are you going, Florida tomorrow, you said?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or no, Caymans.
Oh, you're on the Caymans. Yeah. I see it.
So great. When
that's
you
some business to do down there, huh?
Relaxation.
People that are interested in being an electrician, what advice do you give them now? I mean, you had a long, like, selective path to get to where you were, and you had to make choices along the way. Because you were like solving a problem, you're like, I need
an. Yeah, I kind of ran out of options. Right now, I mean, it was like, I'm going to go do this. I enjoy it, you know. I enjoyed it, but it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't pushed upon me either. Like, like I kind of had to figure that out. Truly, kind of just ran out of options. But, you know, I think that if you really look, I mean, I would think people are way smarter now. Like they're looking ahead. Maybe I'll tell you that when I graduated from the course, right, the 4-year program, and I was one of four, I was like, you know, I started realizing like, well, I'm only one of four people that did this. So
it
seems like I might be, you know, might be a commodity at some point. Right. So But yeah, when I would say that, you know, we are seeing a big push for it right now. So, you know, basically, if you're going to come and if that's the path you are going to go, you know, maybe try to start earlier, right? Get some of that from your high school. There is programs in your high school to do that. I know it gets it gets burdensome because if you're an athlete, it really doesn't schedule well, right? You know, you got to leave your building, you know, and go to the trade school wherever it is in the county and then come back. It can be kind of hard if you have sports that are going to be happening. You know, you have to travel to those sports. You might have to miss your, you know, it's not set up well. Yeah. But basically, yeah, get as much of that information as you can get from them. And then you go to an organization like ours or you know, anyone that offers an apprenticeship program. There's the ABC, there's the IEC, there's groups doing it. You know, you could get into more of a solar. So, you know, like we're doing solar, but you know, there is programs that are like really like the NAPSET courses that you can take. You could probably take a course, you know, that's probably, you know, dedicated to just the NAPSET. You know, I would recommend if you're going to get into the solar industry, you need to be an electrician. You should try to become an electrician first. And then, you know, that's it. I mean, it's a 4-year program, you know, and we pay for half, you know, obviously. So I think that is an incentive. You know, obviously you have to get an A or B to get that benefit from us, but like you'd have to try real hard not to get an A or B, but OSHA 10, right? Get yourself, you know, sort of understand some of the safety it's required to work on these sites. You know, we require everyone that works for our company to get OSHA 30. We pay them to do it. It's sort of a market. I mean, besides being important, it helps us also, you know, show that we take safety serious.
Right.
But basically, you know, we also incentivize people to make more money here. So like if you want to, you know, basically a $2 raise, all you have to do is pass your OSHA 30. It's like that simple, right? So there's another $5,000 in your pocket. And you'd be surprised how many times I get, because I'm in the interview process, this is explained to them. And then, you know, 8 months later, somebody comes to me and I need a raise. I'm like, really? Well, you know, you left $5,000 on the table for the last 8 months, but I don't know. What do you want me to do? Go get your OSHA 30. You know? And I've only had one person do it like immediately, which is hilarious to me. So, but yeah, he got it done in like 3 weeks. Came, I told him about it. In 3 weeks, he's like, "Where's my $2?
Where's my money? Bring me my money."
But yeah. So yeah, no, but it's rewarding, right? I mean, you get to see what you're doing. You're always working yourself out of, you know, we always say you're working yourself out of a job a little bit because you're always having to get the job done to go to the next one. So that makes what we do in here is a different world for me. Like I definitely was very good at doing things in the field.
Yeah.
This is definitely a little bit more difficult for me. So it's kept me, you know, busy.
And I imagine that probably is a big part of the question I was asking before, why so many businesses and the trades never really make it to go the distance that you've gone. You get really good at doing the skill, the job, like mm-hmm. out in the field. But when you're running a business, a different story. Like you said, you got to keep feeding the beast, right?
And yeah, that's 100% different.
I mean,
running a business and operating in one is totally different things, right? So, right. And I spent a lot of time operating in the business instead of running a business. And I've been fortunate to have a good group around me that have helped me get, you know, basically.
Throw them out. Throw their names out.
I mean, there's a few. I mean, dude, you know, there's Shane and Jason. Out. I mean, Josh. Yeah. I mean, we've had and Deb, who's sitting right behind me here. Hey, you know, she's worked for a couple of groups before she worked for us, and she's mm-hmm. been a big part of helping us get to this place too. Stacy, who's in my office, who's been with us for almost, man, it's been 11 years. So, you know, basically, you know, came in and had those skills, right?
Yeah.
And helped pull God Electric together and has been very pivotal in making us successful. You know, I read that, you know, Rich Dad, Poor Dad book, you know, before you quit your job, you know, I read, and one of the things in there that I took away from that book is like, hire the people that know how to do the things you don't. Don't try to do everything. It's because you're going to screw it up. So I've always had an accountant. I've always had an attorney. You know, I've always had the pieces that I needed that have helped us fight through, you know, some of the dumb that can happen in this industry. There's plenty of it. Don't get me wrong. There's a, and it's interesting. Like we keep pushing, you know, the trades, right?
Yeah.
But even, and I mean, this might be a COVID rollover, but there's been a lot of just nobody really, like, one of the things that I think that needs to happen in the engineering side of the world is that an engineer should be forced, you know, like a doctor, you know, you have to go perform under the supervision of someone. An engineer should be made to go pull wire. You know,
right.
They should have to at least experience some of the things that they're drawing.
Yeah.
I mean? It's like, no, we'll just pull that 750 KD, you know, KCML wire, you know, through this. It's insane.
Yeah.
There's some of the stuff we get asked to do is absolutely crazy.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it would be interesting. That would be a really good thing for the world to basically figure out. I think, I don't know, it would make them second guess some of the decisions they're making and make them self-aware of what they're doing too. Like we have a lot of, you know, we deal with a lot of people that I'll sit in meetings and I'll just be like, did he really just say that?
Yeah.
Like he has no idea what he's talking about. Like you just like no idea, like zero idea. Like you wouldn't say that if you had any idea what you're talking about, but they just don't know what they don't know. So
a lot of things look good on paper.
Yeah. I mean, India Solar is, you know, also built, you know, it's a finance based construction, right? So the numbers sometimes don't really work. Like we get told, you know, a lot of time, you know, not a lot, a lot of times we get told we're too expensive. They have to go somewhere else. And it's not that they don't want to use us. It's just that doesn't pencil. And we just don't deviate from what we need to make. So, and we also, I think, provide a better product. Like there's hands down, like there's nobody that does it like us. So, and I'm very comfortable saying that based on what I've seen out there. And then we didn't even tap on the next phase of this. I mean, with what we're talking about, the lack of skilled labor and the lack of, you know, qualified individuals, you know, you're going to see a lot of projects that are and have been built off, you know, just not well, and they require quite a bit of what we call O&M, operations and maintenance services. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that hockey stick is straight up right now. So,
yeah,
which also requires skill.
Oh yeah, no, it's actually the most dangerous thing that I think you can do in the solar industry. 100%. It's not even close. So you're now, you know, a lot of the work, which is nice about solar, is, you know, we're building power plants. They're typically, for the most part, de-energized. You're just building everything, all the infrastructure for all the electricity to flow back to a space, right? Mm-hmm. But that energization of that plant is typically done at the end, and it will be done under the supervision of a lot of smart people. You know, with O&M, when you're going out to fix a project that is built by unqualified people, I mean, you can go out to the wrong project and touch something and die.
Right.
Not grounded correctly. So, like, you just have to be you have to be smart to do that job. So, and it's going to, those are the guys that, you know, we have been fortunate to build this for so long that, you know, I'm able to pull the people in that I feel can handle that level of,
risk,
and risk, right? And then we also require people. So there's, you know, there's courses you can take, obviously, you know, to know what PPE you can wear. The Arc Flash course, 70E Arc Flash course is one that we require, you know, that people take as well. So you have all the, you know, the, you know, 40 cal suits. I mean, but you have to understand that, like, there's certain things that you're not safe no matter what you are wearing.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. That's what that course kind of teaches you, which should be a requirement in the master's exam. It's not. It's weird, right? You're an electrician. You should know what you're allowed to wear, but it's another one of those things. It's like, I don't get it. Well, the app would be good. I mean, any, you know, there's apps for everything else. But yeah, so that there's been a big push for that also on the equipment. So like all of the ArcFast ratings is now, you know, it's been a big, when I first started doing electrical work, that was not a thing. And then, like, it just wasn't. And so now you see every piece of equipment you install has, you know, the rating on it so that you know what you should be wearing when you're working near it.
Got it.
But yeah, O&M's going to be huge. So, I mean, fixing things are going to be, again, like that, you know, you talk about college kids and trying to find something to do. I mean, fixing things is always a good thing to get into, right?
I mean, you're looking at, I'm pulling, you know, data for, like, I'll pull up a college and I'll just look at what their acceptance rate is and then what their graduation rate is. I'm not going to name anyone in this, but, you know, there's colleges out there that are accepting 91% of people.
Ole Miss.
Graduating 43%.
Yeah, it's
43%. I mean, you wonder how you get 40 million people with some college and no degree and a lot of debt looking for what they're going to do next. And,
you know,
these are things that these are the types of things that we're raising, you know, trying to raise awareness of. These are not what that clearly tells you is that there are a lot of people being pushed into a path that they weren't supposed to be in that path. And
100%.
You know,
it's even more than that. It's not just a path they weren't supposed to be in because it doesn't work for them, but
right.
It's also a path that doesn't bear fruit.
It doesn't bear fruit. Well, that's, we can talk about the ROI all day.
It doesn't bear fruit and it doesn't help the world. Like it doesn't help society too. I mean, we also need the people that we're talking about, you know, on the other side of things. Like it's going to become, I use the word mission critical, right? But if we don't fix this problem, and I have been talking about this for quite some time, things are, you know, I already, when I get in an elevator, I'm like looking around, like, you know, this could be it, man. I've seen the guys that built, you know, like I've seen some things, you know, like I've seen, you know, bridges, you know, anything you go, you know, you're getting on, you know, it's like, holy shit, this could be it. You never know.
Right.
You
know, right.
But yeah, it's
tunnels are my worst. I fall off a bridge. I'm like, you know, it'd be awful. But if a tunnel collapsed on you, that's miserable.
Yeah, that would be tough. You wouldn't feel it. You'd be done.
All right, man. We're gonna let you get out of here. You got to get some packing done.
Yeah, my wife is blowing my
phone up. Yeah. Oh yeah. Get out of here. Go pack. Say hello to your wife for me, man. Enjoy your trip. And next time we'll have to bring you in studio. We can have a lot of fun.
Yeah, I definitely like to check it out.
Yeah, for sure. All right, man. Thanks.
I can bring some of my apprentices with me too. They can
come. Bring the whole team. Bring the whole team and do this. Text me a team photo too, because I want to put it with the post. If you got any good team photos with everybody.
Okay.
When you get back, no rush.
Yeah, just remind me. I have someone that we can definitely get that to you for sure.
Yeah. And this is great content because we do a lot of work with actual career schools. And you know, these are the stories that they need to hear it. I mean, that we're going to do everything we can to highlight companies, yours as much as possible. Every successful trades business, we need to have them captured on this type of content that we can show those kids this is what they're working towards, right?
Yeah, and, I mean, it's something real quick. So yeah. Like, when I sat down with Frederick County, basically, you know, they have a program, but basically the kids have to go to school for half the day. Right. So like they get out at 12 and then go.
My notes, right. Yeah.
And issue there is that like that doesn't really make sense, right? So if you have to drive an hour to get to a job that's an hour away and then work for 2 hours, it doesn't really make sense. So what they should try to do, in my opinion, is maybe make them go to school for, you know, 2 days a week or 3 days a week and then give them 2 days to go
learn
trade.
That's cool.
You know what I mean? That way they get the full effect of waking up in the morning, being on time,
right.
You know, having to work all day, you know, it's, you know, it's a real, I mean, that's part of this is it's not easy, man. Like,
right.
This is not easy work. And that's, you know,
were they receptive to it? The idea? Not
zero,
at all.
Zero acceptance to that. The other thing that I think that needs to happen. And I think there's Penn Tech that does this currently. And then there's another school that basically offers sports scholarships to tradesmen, and you can go play sports and learn a trade, which is, we need more of that. Like that's
that's a big one.
We need more of that. That's something we need more of.
I actually just wrote an article about that, trying to make even trades education feel more like school, because that's the big challenge that I have. My son will be far more suited to learn a skill. But he also wants to be on a football team, right? Yeah. You remember when we played in high school, like a lot of the kids that were our teammates are now in the trades, right? But you know, they lose that opportunity to even play on the next level.
You can't say no to that, right? Like, so who am I to say you can't go play at the next level?
That's where I am right now.
It's like, yeah, so it's just, yeah, I mean, I we have this conversation too, because I mean, trust me, like I am talking to my kids, like, look. And they've seen it, right? They've seen this. They understand how they live right now. And and they understand that, yeah, dad did it. Dad can, if dad can do it, I can do it. but basically, you know, it's a real thing. Like that's something that, you know, I feel like somebody should really put a lot of effort into to change.
Well, that's what I ended one of our podcasts saying. I'm gonna get my trades university. Where
I'll help you set that up. Let's do it.
I'd love to work with you on it. And it's all pushing. It's all narrative, and it's all getting one person to buy in, and then it becomes a reality. I'm good friends with someone, the former mayor here in Baltimore. She wanted a design school so that kids could learn how to, make apparel, and she wanted a design school. Guess what? We have a design school now.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So, Merritt was in that school for a bit.
Oh, the school design?
He was there for the first 2 years that it started, the pilot program.
Yeah, that was Catherine Pugh's vision. She wanted that design school, and she got it. And it's all about wanting it and not saying no. And to me, you know, I think kids should be able to get up and go experience a work day, but still come back to campus and go to football practice or
still be able to do what they love to do, right? I mean, you don't want to stop them from being. I mean, sports is such a big part of who they were.
It's identity.
And at the moment that stops, what is that? One, it also does is free them up to do other things that they, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like keep them busy. Keep them busy, right? That's exactly, you know, my daughter, everybody that we have going, I'm like, I'm excited about their opportunity. I told them, I was like, go get the knowledge to run a business, and then I will teach you how to be an electrician, or if you want to be a linesman or whatever it is. I mean, those are really, or go in the military and learn a trade from them. I mean, that's another way to go.
My daughter, my only kid, my first kid, she went to the military. She went to the Coast Guard Academy. I said, you're going to learn some skills there. Right. And,
set up. Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah, she graduated, no debt at all. You're right. They paid her to go.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, I was like,
I heard that. I was like, Birch Marine Academy, boys, let's go. You know,
Kings Point.
Sir. I mean, there's definitely opportunity out there to learn and serve, which I think is important too. I mean, I'm big on that. So,
yeah. All right, man. Enjoy the Caymans. Let's get together when you get back, though.
All right, man.
All right.
It was nice meeting you, sir.
Yeah. Hello.
Good conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, see you guys.
Bye. All right. Yeah, man, that's just one of my favorite people on the planet, and we just, man, 30 years have just gone by so quickly.
Yeah,
I haven't seen his wife, I haven't seen his kids probably in 10, 15, 10, 12 years, probably at least. But
the stat that kind of sticks out to me is that 7 people are leaving the trades or just aging out at the time that only one is coming in. That could be a big problem.
Well, and that tells you, that puts the marker down. Yeah. It definitely puts the marker down as to when the fix was in and college said, no more, you know, we're going to be the only game in town. Everything became about college placement. Right. And SATs, they stopped taking ASVAB. My brother took the ASVAB. It was something that they had to do. And if your aptitude trended more towards trades or military, that's what they pushed to you. You know, the military lost their desk at the career fairs, and trade schools lost their desks at the trade fairs, and it became all colleges. And that's what we're saying. That's why there's only one going in and 7 coming out. But he said some things that were particularly things that we've been writing about. One, he said, what did he say? He said it was, you know, it was my last option. It was, you know, I ran out of options is what he said, right?
Being a good option.
Right? It's the good option. Look at the life he's given his kids right now. And, you know, and we got to get rid of that stigma that says that trades is when you run out of options, go to the trades. No, it can be a first option.
Yeah.
Right. It could be a destination for people.
Yeah, something to be excited about.
And then he said, you know, he was one out of 4 people that graduated out of his was it master electrician class? One of the classes, he said he was one out of four, and he said, "Oh, I might be a commodity."
No, he started with 35 and then so, being one of four of 35.
Right, and which is insane because you go to the University of Maryland, you're going to graduate with 10,000 people with the same credential.
Yeah,
right. That so who you want to compete with? Three people or 9,997? You know, so we've got to do more to everything that we can to start to, you know, really, really join in with this, you know, the movement to change the perception of this industry. Mike Rowe's done a fantastic job, and man, we just got to follow his lead on this one. But yeah, that was some great
good stuff coming up with the trade school
nearby. Yeah, with the trade school nearby, I can't wait to start doing business with them. And the big thing is I want to show them this podcast and every podcast we do like it. Thank you for joining Level Up Podcast. We'll see you next time.